One thing I can tell you is that if you have neurodivergent children, you also might be neurodivergent. That is how I got diagnosed with autism, is that my kids were diagnosed and I look at them and I was like, well, they seem totally normal to me. Oh.
That's Katie Rose Guest Pryle, and I'm Dan Skinner. This is Conversations. In addition to being a world-renowned expert in mental health and neurodiversity, Katie Rose Guest Pryle is a lawyer, professor, bipolar autistic speaker, and award-winning author of more than 15 books designed to help the world better understand neurodiversity. She joins us to talk about her latest book, Your Kid Belongs Here, an insider's guide to parenting neurodiverse children. Katie, welcome to Conversations.
Thank you so much for having me. It's my pleasure to be here.
Well, before we talk about some specific advice from this book, give us an overview. What are readers going to find here?
Back in 2018, my then 6-year-old son, who's now a teenager, was kicked off our little neighborhood swim team. Not the Olympic qualifiers, okay, just the little neighborhood swim team, after 2 days of practice for, frankly, silly reasons. I am a bipolar ADHD mom of two ADHD kids, and ADHD is a portmanteau of autism and ADHD. So we are a neurodivergent family, and at the time, although I was doing my work as a professor and researcher in disability studies, I hadn't turned that lens on my own family. And so when this event happened, it was devastating. I did not tell him about it. He knows now, of course, but as a 6-year-old, I did not tell him that these adults that he frankly looked up to and thought were great just didn't want him there. And it was very painful as a parent. And so I wrote an essay about it, about how neurodivergent kids are frequently excluded from activities that neurotypical families take for granted. The soccer team in the neighborhood, whatever, just pick a thing, chess team. And I published it in the magazine Catapult, which has now closed, but was a lovely magazine back then. And it turned into a monthly column called Mom Interrupted. And I read a monthly column about what it's like to be a parent, a neurodivergent parent of neurodivergent kids. So the book came to be a couple years after I ended the column, when my social scientist brain decided to take a deeper look into these stories I was telling. So as I said, I'm a bipolar ADHD mom, but I'm also a professor. I have a law degree and a PhD in rhetoric. And so I'm a social scientist. I study social forces and how they influence things. And what I found was the systematic exclusion of neurodivergent kids from everyday life. Hence the title of the book, Your Kid Belongs Here. So what readers will find is an outline in this book of how this exclusion occurs across an array of venues, school, you know, friendship, that sort of thing, and why it happens and what we can do to make it better.
I want to start from the very beginning here for people who may not be familiar with the term neurodivergent. And it seems that's an umbrella term that encompasses a lot of different things. But tell us a bit about what you mean when you use that term.
Sure. I define neurodiversity as normal human variations in neurological function, with an emphasis on the word normal. And that's the point. Variations among humans are normal. Some people are taller, some people are less tall. Some people have brown hair, some people have blonde hair. It's normal to have variations. The thing is that certain variations, as history has shown us, are penalized. It's probably not that hard for you, Dan, to think of a variation that might have been penalized, or 10, right? And so to be neurodivergent is one of those penalized variations. Now, when I talk about neurodiversity and to be neurodivergent, these words are a little complicated, but you know, I am not the vocabulary police here is people want to have a conversation about what it means to be neurodivergent or neurodiverse or whatever. We can just use the same word. It's fine. But you'll find people who actually care about the difference. Anyway, I talk about neurodiversity as coming in three basic categories. So there's developmental neurodiversities, and that's what we think of when we say autism or ADHD or dyslexia. And I think what most people think of when they hear the word neurodiversity. But the word is very generous. And so it also encompasses two other types. There's psychiatric neurodiversity, what we call mental illness, anxiety, depression, bipolar disorder. And then there's acquired neurodivergences. And so this is PTSD or post-concussion syndrome or brain fog. So those are ones that might have come on later because of some event in your life. So three types.
As the title of your book indicates, your kid belongs here. There's a problem with educational systems in that they're set up for what they consider to be, quote, normal, and they have a problem handling anything outside of that. So what advice does the book give in terms of advocating for your child and helping your child get the best education they can within that system?
So I like to talk about the metaphor, and I do this in the book's introduction, of a gladiator pit, okay? So if you think about ancient Rome, I was just there and I saw the Colosseum and it was like, yes, I got this right. So in the gladiator pit, there are people in the bottom fighting. And you have parents of neurodivergent kids and you have parents of neurotypical kids. And the parents of neurodivergent kids are saying, my kids need more resources. And the parents of neurotypical kids are saying, your kids are taking all the resources. Teachers are saying, we don't have the resources to care for all these kids. Coaches are saying the same thing, camp counselors, and everybody's fighting against each other. And we're asking the wrong question. What we need to do, if you remember in the Colosseum and the gladiators, we need to look up and see who's sitting in those stands eating grapes, right? So somebody's up there really benefiting from this infighting that's going down in the gladiator pit below. And ask ourselves, why in a culture of such wealth do we have such scarcity? That doesn't make any sense. Now, that's a big, huge, institutional, systemic, societal level question that isn't going to be fixed right away. But just by understanding these forces at work as a parent, when you walk into, say, an IEP meeting, you can understand that, say, teachers are not your enemies. They are under intense pressure from administrators above to keep budgets low. They are completely understaffed when it comes to exceptional children special education, exceptional children teachers. There's never enough. There's never enough of the teachers. There's never enough teaching assistants that can help in the classroom. I live in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. It's one of the nicest school districts in the country. It's top 10 whenever you look at a list. We are totally understaffed. My kids went to public schools up until COVID. And I was astounded by how much support we didn't have. Now, they had wonderful teachers. And I am the first person to tell you that teachers are doing the Lord's work. They are amazing. Special education teachers, EC teachers are saints. I love them. I'm good friends with them. I interview them for pieces that I write. I want to put their voices in the forefront because I think it's easy to cast blame on schools for problems that we have. But it really is this idea of this scarcity of resources that's really a false scarcity of resources.
I'm going to just touch on a few things here because there's so much in the book that we're not going to have time to cover. But I know that being a parent of a neurodiverse child is stressful. And I want to get to your advice about how to take care of yourself in just a moment. But what advice do you have for parents who are dealing with behavioral issues, maybe extreme meltdowns, or the child seemingly incapable of following instructions, et cetera? What's your advice there?
So I have a whole chapter on meltdowns. It's great. And it has to do with meltdowns. So what's a meltdown? It's a stress reaction that is involuntary to emotional dysregulation. So something external to the child has caused the child to feel afraid, and their emotions overwhelm them, and they have this stress response. And so the most important thing to understand here is that a meltdown is not something that the kid can stop. It is an involuntary stress response. A shutdown is like the flip side of a meltdown. We don't hear about them as much because you don't see them in the grocery store, right? It's basically the kid, think about an android in a sci-fi movie booting down. Okay. And they, and quite literally cannot speak, cannot do anything. And this is when you hear criticisms from teachers like, your kid is refusing to blank, the word refuse. And frequently what's happened is that so much stressors, okay, have been put on the child that the child system is protecting itself and just booting down. And they need a brain break to boot back up again, and then they can carry on. So their system is re-regulating through the shutdown. And the same with the meltdown. The system is re-regulating. We have this idea that meltdowns and shutdowns are negative behavioral problems that need to be fixed and made to go away. And the first sort of reframing of this that I want people to think about is that a meltdown and a shutdown, I'm going to talk about them together, is actually a positive thing. The Emmy Award-winning comedian and author Hannah Gadsby describes their meltdowns as a real spring clean or cleaning the pipes. And I love this metaphor because it's precisely my own experience. You're overwhelmed. Everything just is so trapped inside you. And then you just flush it out with a meltdown. And inevitably, after my children had meltdowns, they just perked back up again. Now, I'm a mess because of the judgment of people in public, for example. If people are judging me in public, which they frequently do, if they see a kid throwing what looks like a temper tantrum, they think, what a spoiled child, what a bad parent. It's called social policing, okay? And it's extraordinarily difficult to ignore that. But if we can help our children when they do have meltdowns, which they will inevitably do, have them in a safe place, maybe a private place that helps us as parents not feel like we're getting gawked at, okay? And tell them we love them and tell them we care for them instead of trying to suppress it. If we allow the pipes to get cleaned, inevitably they are over quicker. The kids bounce back so fast. I mean, melting down 1 minute and the next minute, hey mom, want to go to McDonald's and get French fries? And it's sort of captivating to watch how the meltdown does its job re-regulating a nervous system. Now, ideally, we prevent whatever it was that caused that emotional dysregulation in the first place, okay? And there's a variety of ways to do that. So when a kid has a meltdown or a shutdown, if you're a parent, if you're a teacher, a coach, don't think about, okay, we got to stop this. What we need to think about is what happened 5, 10, 20 minutes prior that caused this to happen? And that's the thing we need to stop.
Another area you talk about in the book is masking, which, correct me if I'm wrong, but I see it's also kind of a response to those societal pressures that the child is trying to hide what's really going on with them. So they come up with these masking behaviors. Why is that detrimental to the child? And why is it important for them to be free to express what's really going on?
I think most parents can relate, whether your kid is neurotypical or neurodivergent, to the kid coming home from school and immediately falling to pieces when they get home. They've kept it together all during the school day. They've had to sit still. They've had to, you know, follow all these fairly rigid rules. And then they get home and they've been keeping it together and they just can't anymore because they've come to a safe place. You are safe. You are going to love them no matter what. You're not going to give them bad grades. You're not going to chastise them or embarrass them and humiliate them in front of their peers so they can come home. And then they come home and have that after school temper tantrum or whatever, right? It's really a meltdown. And even neurotypical kids have these emotional sort of, well, we'll just call it cleaning the pipes, right? After school. For neurodivergent kids, it's even harder. And so the word masking, it's pretty basic. It means hiding your neurodivergent traits to appear more neurotypical to keep yourself safe, safe from punishment, bullying, and any other thing that would make you a target because you are displaying neurodivergent behaviors. So you're basically faking normal. And it is wicked exhausting, okay? It is so exhausting. And so at the end of the day, a neurodivergent kid comes home and they will fall to pieces. Or a neurodivergent adult. And it's not limited to kids. So that's what masking is. The thing is that masking is required because of these neurotypical norms that we expect kids to perform. And so if we thought about maybe expanding what's normal, okay, this would solve masking. Maybe it is okay to wiggle more or to bring a stuffy that you can and cuddle in class or whatever, okay? These rules that are, you know, some teachers are more into enforcing than others, let's say. I had a wonderful teacher for one of my sons when he was in second grade. They were doing a class performance and everybody had to wear a silver metallic bow tie, but it was an itchy material. And for my kid, it was a sensory nightmare. He could not deal with how this belt around his neck. It felt like he was being strangled. It was itchy, scratch himself. And so the teacher said, "It's okay. You don't have to wear it. No big deal. It's a lot of bow ties up here. No one's going to even notice." And she was right. I didn't even notice until later. And that prevented the need for him to keep it together and like deal with this like just irritant that's hard to describe unless you've experienced it. It's, imagine just feeling like ants are biting your neck for hours on end. I mean, that's just not great. And so the best teachers expand what's acceptable. Is it totally necessary for every kid to wear the silver bow tie? And the answer is no, just isn't.
There's one other area I want to cover quickly before we wrap this up. And I mentioned that before, and that's the parents, because this is stressful for the parents as well. So what advice do you have for them to take care of themselves?
Sure. One thing I can tell you is that if you have neurodivergent children, you also might be neurodivergent. That is how I got diagnosed with autism, is that my kids were diagnosed and I look at them and I was like, well, they seem totally normal to me. Oh, and then I went and we have a testing center, actually a autism center as part of the University Medical Center where I live. I'm very lucky that we have this. And so I went in and was tested and they're like, oh yes, you're quite autistic as well. And then I tell my mother this, and this might be the most Gen X story you've ever heard. My mom said, oh yeah, you were diagnosed with ADD when you were in first grade. And I said, I was what? And she said, oh yeah, but we didn't, you know, really do anything about it. Nor did they tell me. Okay, so I spent my entire life with ADHD, had no idea until after I was diagnosed with autism. I was like, it would have been really helpful to know that. And, you know, it turned out all right, but it was hard. It was hard to negotiate all the challenges, executive functioning challenges. You might have heard that word, you know, being forgetful and not being able to keep my stuff together. And this is what we're talking about with parents. You ask your kid to go upstairs and get dressed, you know, your second grader, and you're like 30 minutes later, you go upstairs and they're like in their underpants coloring their desk, right? What's happening here? And that is executive function challenges. That is the CEO in your brain that tells the rest of your brain how to do stuff, how to concentrate, plan, follow, complicate, like multi-step instructions. And our children develop executive functioning later. Okay. It's just a thing that it comes eventually, but it comes later. And my first piece of advice after the maybe take a look in the mirror is to decrease the demands we put on our kids. So if your kid is struggling to tie their shoes because of executive function challenges, which include things like complicated little things with your fingers, okay? Then buy them slip-on shoes. It doesn't matter. They don't have to know how to tie their shoes when they're 6, 7, 8, even 12. I'll tell you what, I don't like to tie shoes today. I prefer to slip-on shoes myself. So just decrease the number of demands that you can put on them by buying only clothes they find comfortable. Don't force them to wear clothes they don't like. There's no reason to. There's so many nice-looking clothes made out of like slick materials that feel good on the skin. And so for kids with sensory issues, they don't have to wear clothes that aren't stretchy. They have stretchy dress pants. They have stretchy dress shirts. They have dress shirts that have fake buttons down the front that you pull on like a t-shirt. These are demands that we do not have to put on our kids anymore. We can lower those demands. When we lower those demands, we lower the amount of things that we fight with our kids about, which is better for us. So knowing your own neurotype can help you realize that you're masking. If you're emotionally dysregulated, that's important. Lowering the demands on our kids means that we're not fighting with them all the time. We're not enforcing those norms, which is exhausting. And then, of course, you have a better relationship with your child. So those are two big pieces of advice that I can give parents right now.
Well, there's much more in the book that we don't have time to talk about. So to learn more, the book is Your Kid Belongs Here, an insider's guide to parenting neurodiverse children. It's by Katie Rose Guest Prile. Katie, thank you very much for talking with me today.
Thank you, Dan. I had a blast.
You'll find more interviews on a wide variety of topics at kansaspublicradio.org/conversations. You can use the KPR app to listen to the latest episodes on your phone or tablet, and you'll also find us on Facebook. I'm Dan Skinner. Thanks for listening.